Welcome back. We're going to do module two.
Yeah, we're on to module two already. And we're taking a look at our lessons learned and development planning in general, right? So we're going to talk a little bit about what we kind of bumped into, the issues that we ran into. And then we're going to take a look at, you know, best practices and in our opinion on how you can mitigate some of these issues.
Right. And even why starting a simple project that, you know, you're only asked to go so far, might expand, and therefore you should have done all of these things ahead of time. All right, so what did we learn from the first prototype? Mm-hmm. We're going to cover that in this module to start. And then we're going to move into what are the good and the bad takeaways from that? You know, what lessons can you learn from doing something like that? And, you know, sooner or later, you'll run into a project where you do the same thing and you'll learn these same lessons. So we're trying to buffer that and, you know, get that ready for you. So you can be like, oh, that's what they were talking about. Now I get it. And then we're going to go into a discussion of our common planning practices for most projects, especially when we know that they are going to be of any kind of decent size or last, you know, a development of more than a week or something like that. Mm-hmm. All right, so the first section, what did we learn from the first prototype?
And I'm going to start off right off the bat here with an apology. I apologize. I should have known better than to have built the original prototype the way I did. And what I did was I thought to myself, I want to make this as simple and easy for everyone to understand. And I thought, well, what's easier than having everything kind of in the same file? You can just kind of walk through it and see the structure line by line. Back then, that seemed like a great idea, until we decided that we were going to upgrade this a little bit and add some more functionality. And then I realized I coded myself into a corner.
Right.
Right? By only having everything in one file, I basically tied everything together. And when I started to, you know, pull on the proverbial cards, it collapsed.
Right.
Right? So I actually literally spent more time having to re-engineer the project to be functional and updatable than I did actual coding. So how many years of experience have I had? And I still did it. So, you know, it's something that we can all bump into. But yeah, I want to say right off the bat, I apologize for thinking that way. And it's definitely something you want to avoid. So the first thing that we did is we took the project. And you'll notice in the source code, if you look at the old source code compared to our new source code, the structure's a lot different. We took everything, we broke it up into its own, I don't want to say classes because we're in JavaScript. Let's call them object files. I moved them all into separate files so that way it would be easier to read, more intuitive, and easier to work with.
Right. So I just popped up a shot here. So there you can see that in our JS code now, we've broken them down into files instead of one large file for you just to organize things a bit easier. All the quest-related code's going to be in the quest.js file when we get to that today. All the MPC code from before is in the MPC.js file, and so on and so on. So it's you know, what it should have been done the first time, how it should have been organized kind of deal, broken down into nice sections, easier to follow, easier to work with, and stuff like that. So we're going to go into the details and, you know, why that's a little bit better.
Exactly.
All right, so with that out of the way, always make a plan.
Yes, and that's exactly it, right? Even with a toy example like this, you got to make a plan. You got to sit down. Where is this going in the next year, 2 years, 6 months out? Where do I want to see this?
Right.
And you know, and make that plan. Sit down and actually think it through.
And even where is it going to go? Where might it go? Mm-hmm. Right. You don't have to have a full plan for that, but just keep the vision there of what you want. But you know, keep in the back of your mind, what might they ask me to do further, especially when you are doing something like this, where it's more of an educational or a demonstration purpose or so on. You could be going to a conference or whatever, and they want you to take it along that. It's the same kind of thing if you're building a game and, you know, oh, it gets wildly successful. Well, darn, I never even thought I would ever need to work in this or patch it or add DLC or expand mm-hmm. it or make an expansion or have to use it for a spin-off game and I want to use the same engine, but it's really hard-coded and tied to that character. Well, that's not going to be very helpful, right? So have the plan, for knowing that, you know, if this does well, which is the idea usually when you do something, that it's going to expand in some way, and you'll want to have, you know, that ability and be prepared for that.
Well, it doesn't matter what project it is, it's going to expand, right? No project is ever going to stay the same size or stay stagnant. If you're developing it, it's going to expand. And that's the thing, right? If you look at the equation there, no plan plus an expanding code base equals a very unhappy coder. So make sure, yeah, like, you know, because it's what happened to me. I was banging my head off the wall and cursing this code for a long time just because I did that to myself.
You know what? You did make it a nice, easy, readable, simple format to begin with, and everybody appreciates that. And then really now only your time has been wasted. And now we get all these valuable lessons and we get to see how it should have been done. And, you know, they're happy they didn't have to do any of the work.
Exactly.
So it's okay.
I guess, yes. And that kind of brings us to the next point. It's keeping it simple.
Right.
Might not be so simple, right? So, you know, like me walking through, and to be quite honest, there was times even in the first demo where we were adding a little bit of hacky code just to satisfy the need of being structured that way.
And or as simple as possible. Sometimes mm-hmm. we were just cutting things out or shortcutting it. Or, you know, that's good enough just to keep it simple so that we could keep the complexity down of learning what was going on mm-hmm. as easy as possible.
And that's the thing, right? Like, I was really trying to focus on the simplicity of learning the tools than I was worrying about the actual structure. And honestly, that was a big mistake on my part. I should have actually went with it. Let's teach structure, then the tools, then on, right? So, you know, definitely something to keep in mind. If you think that this toy example is so simple, don't build it as if it was just a toy example. Build it as if you're expecting it to become a huge project.
Exactly. And the next one, of course, comment.
So actually, speaking of that, one of the comments that I got in the previous example was that we didn't have enough comments.
There you go.
So we spent a lot of time, and if you're looking at the source code now, you're probably going, wow, they wrote a novel in here. And the reason for that is I wanted to make sure that every line of code in there was explained, not only what it was doing, but what the intended purpose of that code was.
Right.
So you'll notice that we went to some pretty extreme details to make sure that you guys know what that code is doing.
And to some degree, that's a little too much comments.
Yes.
For a production like code base.
Yeah, but if you're building a game that you're, you know, going to release and it's just your team working on it, generally you don't need to comment this deeply. But again, I wanted to go to the extreme just to make sure that everybody knew exactly what was going on, especially because we broke the files up as well.
Right. Now that it's not as simple and it's not built in an easy to learn fashion per se, if you're brand new to programming anything and you're trying to make your first game, now the comments really would have been the process of you describing it in the first one of exactly what is going on. Now all that detail is in there for you just to help with your learning process, but we can now structure it and build it in a way that we can keep expanding it, adding multiplayer, doing some, you know, throwing more people onto the project because now there's, you know, easier to work together when there's more files and not everybody's stepping on each other's toes needing to merge all the files together.
Exactly.
Things like that. So. All right, that brings us to really the good and the bad
prototype. I could have sat here and went through the bad for hours. the good, not so much. But we did have some good in there. I'm not gonna knock the project too much. It was fast and easy to get coded.
That's right.
Right, like we sat down, we coded that pretty quick. Mm-hmm. And that's because, you know, there wasn't a lot of structure to it. So it was pretty easy for us to get in there and do that. And that kind of, I kind of like to call that the siren song of coding. Right, it was drawing me in, and of course I hit the rocks. So you know, just something to keep in mind. Yes, it is faster, but that may not necessarily be a good thing.
That's right. And in terms of bad,
well, another good one was we had no file management.
That's true.
Now, a lot of people are like, oh well, you know, I don't have to worry about all these different files and making sure that they're all calling each other properly and, you know, the structure and stuff like that. So that is one bonus.
Because that can be a bit trickier in JS than some other programming languages, is the sort of the nesting of separated code.
Yeah, and when we get into the code, together, we'll point a little bit of that out. What we did was we kind of structured it in a way so that it was easy to read. Because like you said, with prototyping and stuff like that inside of JS, it's easy to kind of lose track of how the files are interacting with each other.
Right.
So what we did was we kind of avoided the prototyping style and kind of went to more of the function call style so that we were actually exposing certain functions so that you could see this is the functions that are exposed from my file that are going to be a talk to from other files. So that was kind of how we managed that.
Exactly. So some of the bad was, of course, that it ended in one massive, really long file.
That was a very big file.
There was a lot of scrolling usually when you had to find some piece of code that you wanted to alter or
change. Control F became your friend very quickly in
that
one.
I think those keys got worn out on my keyboard during the demo even last time.
Exactly.
But again, the other bad thing was no file management. So now you couldn't go to where you wanted a discrete chunk of code. You knew that this was a player function. Where is the player code? And you had to go through the whole thing instead of just opening the
player file. And with that too, like some of the player code was up at the top of the file. Some of the player code might have been down at the bottom of the file. That makes it really hard to step through and to know what you're looking for. So by having this file management, by breaking them up, like I'm like, oh, something's wrong with the quest. I'm not scrolling for hours. I'm just going to go to the quest file and take a look at what's in there.
Yep. And then not usable really with more than one coder because you'd all be working in the same file, then you have to constantly merge with each other and make sure you didn't step on anybody else's code and so on.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is a bad problem. You can't really bring two or three extra people onto the project to help you out.
Yeah, because they're not going to, you know, if it's all in one file, and like we said, it was really, really tangled. I called it the rat's nest of coding there because it was really tangled up. So then you bring somebody new in and they're spending more time stepping through the code, learning how the code runs than actually fixing the problem that you asked them to help out with. Right.
And then once they fix that, you've probably already done three or four other things, and now they have to make sure...
That probably broke what they fixed.
It doesn't line up, that's right.
Yes.
So those are just some of the things that, you know, were good about the prototype in terms of what it was really geared to originally, but that were definitely going to be bad about the prototype if we tried to expand it now, which is what we wanted to do. So you had to do all that work of organizing everything and breaking it all apart again. So that we're going to go into the implementing of these lessons learned.
Exactly.
In terms of what you have done over the last little while to get it to the state where it is. For example, making a good plan. What did you do this time around?
Well, the first thing I did was I sat down with a piece of paper and I decided how I wanted things to work. I have a really large whiteboard in my office, which is very helpful. So I actually did. Paper prototype for the game, I sat down and thought, this is my class structure, this is how things are going to interact, and actually, we're going to get into this a little bit later, but that actually helped me build diagrams by doing that. So I was able to do the initial hand copy of things, and then not only did that give me a good structure and know where I wanted to take the project and what I was looking at, but it also helped me down the road when I started to build out actual documentation and diagrams.
Okay, that's good. So write everything down?
Yes,
where you want
write everything
to
down.
All right. And then include how you intend to implement those features. You did that. That was part of that process as well. Taking note of any alternate approaches.
Yes. So, as you're working on it, you're thinking, okay, well, this might be the best way I'm thinking of doing it. But, you know, it's always a good idea just to kind of step back and go, is there a separate approach that I could take to this? Is there an easier way? Is there a way that's going to be more beneficial for the project as a whole? So it's going to make it more flexible.
Especially if it was a risky topic, right? Mm-hmm. Had you ever done a multiplayer setup with all this stuff before?
No, I had never actually built anything multiplayer with Node.js and WebSockets.
Right. So that's an area where, there's a risk here. We're not quite sure if it's going to work, but it's a critical part of sort of what we want to demo. So what would be the backup plans? You know, you might take two or three or just say, we need to figure out a backup plan while we're working on whatever we're doing because this might fall down
and
or
actually,
go sideways.
I took that one step further. What I did was I built small little prototypes of the different ways that I could do it. So I did one with, I spun up an instance of a Linux distribution inside of Azure and built the server that way. And I thought, well, you know, that's good, it works, everything's fine. And then I sat back and I said, that seems a little overkill for my project. I don't really need a full server running as an instance in Azure.
Right.
So I thought, is there a better way of doing it? And then I noticed that I could build a Node.js server with just an Azure website. So I went and built a little prototype like that and tested it out and saw the comparative differences and saw it. And I was like, well, there's not really any major difference there. So I thought, well, let's just scale it back and go with the Azure website.
Right. A little bit easier to set up, a little less overhead, that kind of stuff. So that's good for a demo. So
exactly.
That went in. All right. So then, of course, that leads right into the next point, which is pick appropriate tools and technologies that are going to cover your requirements. You know, it's okay to, if it also covers maybe some extensions and so on that you were thinking that you might go beyond in the future with your project. But really you want the one that sort of has the nicest fit. It doesn't do anything extra, doesn't waste any time doing something that you don't really need, that kind of stuff. So you always want to try to assess the tools and the technologies that are out there and bring in the appropriate one for that project that you are designing.
Well, exactly. Like I could have went deep and went, I'm going to build a IP stack, or I'm going to do UDP. Like, and then I thought about it. Well, do I really need that for this project?
And he's just throwing out large words. I mean, don't worry about it.
These are different protocols that I could have used for networking. Thank you. Different networking protocols is what I'm talking about there. And then I decided that WebSockets is really all I really needed for that. Right.
Right. Which is a nice HTML5.
It fit nicely with what I was doing and everything. So that was my right technology and the right tool for the specific project.
Now, you did bring on another person.
Yes, I did. And big shout outs to Will Stay. He's probably watching somewhere right now. He was fantastic. We've worked together a lot in the past, so he definitely was a big help on this project. He jumped in.
But of course, when you bring on somebody like that, sometimes you need to clear up any coding convention
questions. Yes, so between the two of us, we have a different outlook on how JavaScript should be structured. So there was a little bit of debate when I first brought him onto the project on how we were going to structure things. And every once in a while, you might notice a little bit of differences between the files, and that's because the two of us were working together in tandem on it.
Right, so whenever you work on it, in a team project in this fashion, sometimes there are those coding convention questions, especially with certain languages that are a lot less strict about the way you do certain things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's good it's always good to just, bite that in the bud, get in there earlier, and talk about it and figure out how you want to work with the certain style elements of it. It just makes it easier for when other people are looking in your code, if it's all the same, that they can easily read what's going on.
It might seem silly, but something as simple as putting braces in a certain format, right? It's how we code, it's how we interpret things, and it's, when I'm running through code, if I'm expecting to see a certain format and I don't see it, it might slow me down.
Right.
So, make sure you talk between the team and see what's best for everybody. Obviously, we're all going to have different opinions, but you got to find that middle ground.
Right. And again, even in large AAA companies, a lot of them will have a coding standard document that they will hand to new employees, or that is available on their internal wiki or something like that, where you can just see those things stipulated where should the brace go right after the end of the function or on the next line, on an empty line, et cetera, et cetera. It's just common practice for a lot of the companies now anyway. So just going through the process of making a coding standard, even a small group, and having those discussions, you'll see what sometimes the large AAA companies sometimes have to face, where people will just argue over where that
brace not putting
goes.
Semicolons.
Yeah, exactly. You don't need them, right?
In JavaScript, you don't necessarily need to have semicolons.
So why would I want to have to type them on the end of every line?
Exactly, right?
So those things, clear those up. That's part of this getting things ready and getting things, organized for a team to go out and do a project successfully together. It just reduces frustration over the long run.
Oh, big time.
For sure. So also, don't be afraid to pseudocode your implementations. Like you said, you went in and made little demos of stuff, but sometimes just pseudocoding is enough to figure out if your thought process is clear in what you thought was how it was going to work or what was intended. You can then run through the code sort of in your head and figure it out. And pseudocode, if you don't know, it's just basically writing down on paper in plain English what you wanted to do, sort of format it like you were doing code. So if it was going to be an if statement, you would just say, if this is greater than whatever, do this, blah, 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 and indent that next line. But there's no brackets, there's no semicolons. Yeah. It doesn't look like any language. It's just plain English, sort of organized in your thought process so you don't even have to worry about what code. Maybe sometimes projects don't even know what language they're going to be or what engine they're going to be on yet, but you're setting up the structure for the different game elements, how powers work, how the systems talk to one another. You can pseudocode those out in document form so that it doesn't really matter what language they end up getting written in the end anyways. And that becomes an aid when you do have a team for other developers who need to implement a certain piece. You can give them the pseudocode. Could you do the player class? Here's what I was thinking for those abilities. Here's how it's going to communicate with the enemy and the physics system and so on. And you just already have it sort of pseudocoded out and written out for them.
Yeah, and when I was working with Will, that's actually one of the things we did is we pseudocoded a lot of the quest structure and a lot of the multiplayer structure, just so that we both knew kind of like how we wanted it to flow. And then we just kind of broke off and went ahead and coded it on our own, right? So
right.
That's what's really nice about that. If you write that pseudocode, you can pass it around the team, and everybody kind of knows what the code is supposed to be like, and then they can just kind of go and implement it on their own.
And there's another scaled back approach with using UML diagrams for just that kind of overall communication structure.
And we'll actually touch on that a little bit soon.
Yeah, we'll get to that as well. So some other lessons that were learned, picking a feature freeze date.
Yes, watch out for that scope creep.
So if you do pick pick a, you know, a freeze date, and you should, leaving yourself enough time to do whatever it is to clean up and polish and get it all, everything else ready for a demonstration, maybe at a conference or whatever. You want to demo this game off to an investor or something like that. And even in actual development, you need a feature freeze date.
And you'll likely have multiple freeze dates, right? You'll have freeze dates for each sort of build.
Yep.
Right, when you're building bigger projects. So like you said, if I was going to a conference and I was going to be building a demo just for that conference, we're going to pick a specific date that no other features are going to go into so that we know we can actually finish it.
Right, for that conference.
For that build.
And then after that, everybody
And then
can
you
continue.
Remove that freeze and then you're going to add new things, right?
And this also applies to multiple teams as well, not just game features, but also you'll typically see an art freeze date or a video freeze date for any cinematics that you have for actually each cinematic will probably even have one, and then they'll polish up what's in there as opposed to, you know, working with it or testing different shots and so on. You'll have a freeze date for that. So there's lots of asset freeze dates and feature freeze dates that you will see in a typical project of like a decent
size. And I find that's pretty much the best way to fight the scope creep is to have those freezes, right?
Then everybody knows what date they're working against, and you know they know their own abilities, so they know sort of how much themselves they can try or try to get in or try to practice with and find.
You know
the
best what game
thing.
Developers are like with with deadlines, right? So
yeah, they'll just keep expanding if you don't pin them down.
Exactly.
So also make sure that you have a good source control system for sure.
Very, very important
before you start, because even this initial documentation you want tracked, and you want the revisions, and you want what edits were made and who made them. For all of even your documentation, okay? It's not just for code or just for art assets. You want it for the documentation too. Maybe you do get another round of investing or funding and they actually want you to expand the game a little bit more because it's great, but they want it bigger. Well, now that's a great time to go back through and grab like the older version that you know you cut a whole bunch of features out of your game design document. You know, what were they? What were they great? And that way you don't have, it's the same thing with commented code. You don't want commented code just sitting in there of this works really well, but we don't have time to get the particle effects for this power. So I'll just comment it out and leave it in there. No, you want to remove the code and check it back into your repository. And you can always go back to that version of the file if there's a time later on where you want to then implement it. That's the whole point of having this, as well as, oops, the computer just died and everything's gone. Well, you know, you have a nice little server sitting somewhere and it's tracked all your changes, and other than the last like 20 minutes or whatever you're working on, you know, you can go back and see and grab all that code and get it back into play. So that's, you know, why you want to have that, even on a small project. There's a number of times where I've seen students corrupt their game on the last day before they're going to hand it in or install new drivers in their system. I mean, you know, and something goes wrong and they don't know what's going on. So you want to have that fallback no matter who you are or how big your project is or how much time you have to work on stuff. You will want to have, you know,
and
a reliable
backup.
To
be quite honest, that's why all of these projects are sitting on Git. It's not just because it's a great place for me to hand you guys code. It's a great place for me to be able to keep track of the code and modify the code.
And there's other ones. You can do Subversion, Team Foundation, Perforce. There's all kinds
systems
out there for source control. Some of them have extra features. Some of them have nice GUIs.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the power user ones that are just command line.
Yeah, Visual Studio actually supports Team Foundation Server and Git right out of the box. So if you have a Team Foundation Server repository already set up, it's going to be able to pull that in. And another thing that is with Git is it's you can actually check in and commit code right inside of Visual Studio.
Right, because they have that plugin.
I don't have to worry about opening up a separate GUI and messing around with that. I can actually just do it that way.
Exactly. So leave at least 60% of your project time for testing, bug hunting, polishing, iteration. Right, like there's a lot of time there that people are like, I got a week. So, you know, as long as I finish up by Friday, I'll be done for Saturday and we're good. You spend, you know, I always had this one story. Somebody would tell me, we plan, 60% of our time for developing, and then we end up doing another 80% of our time for bug testing. Like, okay, that explains a lot of games going over budget and being way late, right? You need more time for bug hunting, for polishing, for wrapping all of those things up, all those loose ends, and making sure everything plays right, balance testing after that, right? You need a lot of time for that, and you got to have everything nailed down before you can really do that.
Yeah.
So, the development time should be short compared to the rest of your time of polishing everything up. maybe you get really good at polishing and writing great code as you get better and there's no bugs and so on, great. Then you can start to, maybe shift that number a little bit down and so on. But when you're a beginner or even if you're a professional with 5-10 years, and you're running a large team, you need a lot of that cleanup time comparatively to development time.
Big time, right? We've all seen what happens when you ship broken code.
Yep, so. It just, yeah. People get mad, you lose fans, or you get new rivals, and the internet loves to hold on to everything you've done wrong forever.
Yep, they don't forget.
That's right. So set up a bug tracking system goes into that as well. Now that you're going to spend a lot of time smashing all those bugs, you might as well have a good system to track them so that as soon as somebody experiences one, they can put it right in and let you know, and then the right person gets the bug, they can evaluate it, maybe they can't reproduce it, they can push it back, they already know who sent it to them because that's all tracked. So there's different ways to do that. I mean, at the very least, set up an Excel sheet for it, have good columns in there, when it was found, what revision it was found in, who found it, the steps to reproduce it, what the expected outcome was, but what actually happened, okay? Like, all those columns can be in there. You can color code it all, and it makes a nice, simple sheet to type right into if you don't want to go the extra mile and get a
professional tool that actually tracks it, yes.
So that also leads into, depending on the size of your team, you may need actually a productivity tracking tool.
Very true.
Right? So you know who's working on what when, what your tasks are coming up. And you can use Gantt charts for this. I coded up a small Gantt chart one time for a small indie team. It was just a little web app that they could use. And they could go in, enter people, type in little tasks, and it would show up in sort of a staggered thing, showing you what task connected to another one. So you knew you can't start this task until you finish that. Or this other person, Susan down here, she can't start that her tasks, her work, until you get this done. So it shows you all the interconnections that way. You can see who's relying on your work to be done. So I really got to be on time.
It ties in nicely with your any bug tracking that you have, right?
That's right.
So these are all systems that kind of work together that really speed up production and make sure that everybody's on the same page and not stepping on each other's toes or undoing code and stuff like that.
And again, you could do a simple Excel or Access, page to try to do that kind of stuff. And there are professional tools that bring these together, like Handsoft and so on, which I've used before, and that's a neat one. So there's a bunch of them out there that can help you manage this side. And really, that's a production management job, but even in small teams.
Hey, when you're an indie, you're wearing all the hats.
That's right.
So you got to make sure that you know that what these tools are and how they can help you.
All right, so that brings us to our next section, basically, which is proper documentation.
Yes.
It's a great way to start out planning and making sure everybody knows what's going on.
This is the beginning of your planning process.
That's right. So the first and most important document is usually the game design document. All right, this is a living document, meaning it's going to change over the lifetime of the project. Okay, it contains the game's mechanics and story and backstory. All right, target audience usually is in there, direction, the schedule for how long the game's going to take and who's going to do it. That's usually an appendix or whatever, or built out into a separate document on its own because it's so important. The control scheme for the game should be in there, and any of those other related topics to the game itself, because this is the document that you could give to a new employee or a new team member that joins your group and wants to help out. That rather than you having to sit there and tell them every single little detail because you stored it only in your mind, this document can now help them. They can go back to it and that way they don't have to memorize everything you said immediately and look at all the different changes and see where they're at, see what changes have happened over while they were just getting caught up on the project. Stuff will change. So you want a nice living document.
Kind of like a development manual, if you will.
That's right.
It kind of describes the process and where the game's going, what the game's about, how things are going to be implemented, who's working on what. It's a very, very, very important document. I've walked into companies that haven't had this document, and it's been a nightmare.
It's organized chaos.
Yeah. Just something, even if it's just a very, very simple version, if you got a 5-man team or something like that, you don't need to go to extremes and build out this amazingly huge document.
Right.
But at least have these things on hand and keep it up to date. That's the big one. Keep it up to date. As things change, like you said, it's a living document. It's not going to stay the same. So every time you make a little change to your plan or to the input scheme or whatever it might be, make sure that's reflected in your GDD.
And if you know that this document is going to be large, maybe you're planning an RPG and there's a lot of depth, a lot of characters, a lot of backstory, a lot of abilities, all that kind of stuff, items and so on, make sure that the document itself is you know, accessible to everybody easily.
Yes.
So a wiki version of it might be nice mm-hmm. instead of a hard copy version that you have to constantly edit and photocopy and reprint from Word or something
like that.
Yeah,
let's not destroy a bunch of trees.
Exactly. Make it searchable, you know, in some way, whatever facility you're using to host it, basically make sure it's searchable. And of course, version track it with your source control mm-hmm. or whatever, if that's possible, or built into the wiki system, turn on your source control just so that you can keep all the changes. Sometimes people hit the wrong button and delete a whole page and yes. there goes all of your game mechanics,
before.
You know, oops. So you want to be able to roll back and get all that information. So it's a very important document. I've seen GDDs that are this thick when printed out.
Yeah.
Okay, so 400 pages can happen easily for a triple A game, no problem. Okay, and those documents, sometimes there's a person's job who is just the keeper of that document. Mm-hmm. And literally that's their job, so that the entire 100-person team, 50-person team is constantly abridged with all the changes and can keep up to date.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very important
document. Very important document.
That brings us to a secondary document, which sometimes is an appendix to the game design document.
A lot of times it can be, yep.
Depending on the size of it, okay? And this one's the technical design document. So it serves the same purpose as a GDD, but it's directed more to the technical staff. So it serves the same purpose.
So I like to think of it as the GDD describes the way we're going to do it. The TDD describes exactly how it's going to be implemented.
Right. So, the GDD is the ideas in the game that you want to have mm-hmm. in the end, and the TDD is how they're going to make that happen.
Yeah.
So it lays out the plan of action for developing the game's engine. You're going to see things on the tools that you need to facilitate it. Maybe you have an art pipeline, getting a model in. So that would be in here also, how we're going to tackle that problem. Maybe you're making your own new file format or something crazy mm-hmm. like that. And any other technical hurdles that your tech team really is going to have to overcome, that all should be in your technical design document. Now, they're usually the ones that are going to write it for you in conjunction with, you know, looking at the GDD and seeing what you're asking for. So they'll build it as a separate document, and that's why the GDD is the main document, mm-hmm. because that's where they're getting all the information for what it is they're going to need on the back end side. To go
and that's why you see
it
a lot of times. It's just an appendix of the GDD
right.
because of that. It's really built off of the GDD.
Yeah, and it's something the whole team doesn't need to worry about. Just
exactly.
your technical people. Mm-hmm. So it also sometimes will outline the budgets and the resources that are needed or that is given rather by the engine or whatever you're building to each group. So how much memory, for example, the cinematic team is allowed to use because we need to preload a level behind it as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much memory is allowed for the particle systems at any one given time. So that gives other, like art team members and so on, an understanding of, okay, if I'm making a particle system that needs to be everywhere in this level, they can budget it to make it look as good as possible, but at the right memory footprint that it will be playable under that budget when the game goes to run.
Nice.
So those technical details, those are the kinds of things that you're going to be finding also in the TDD, besides just the structure of how they're going to build the whole engine. Typically, you also see UML diagrams,
mm-hmm.
Which we're going to take a look at because we're going to show you how you can use them to plan out your code and your systems. So UML diagrams, we'll talk about them in a minute. You can do things like spec out classes with them,
mm-hmm.
Show sequence diagrams. So what order, for example, player joins the chat room, and then you know what communication needs to happen with security to verify their credentials, and then you let all your other players know in the general chat room that they're there and so on, and introduce their name. And you basically just line up all the tasks and you get to see how they're all going to interact and in what order, where the fail safes are, and then how the process of doing all the different actions in that chat room would be.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the kinds of like different things you can show with these UML diagrams. So they'll usually be in your technical design document, sometimes in your GDD for game mechanics as well. All right. So the last major document mm-hmm. That you sometimes find is the art design document. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this one because this is the least useful one for what we're doing
exactly.
right now. But I'll mention it just so that you know there is an art side to this. There is a chunk. Again, it's usually appendix of the GDD or sometimes its own document when it gets really big. It's mainly used solely by the art staff of a team to coordinate their artistic effort to work on each individual level. A lot of levels will have a different color theme, a different color palette, you know, a different feel. They'll know what the tension of the story is supposed to be here.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll be using colors that are going to move towards that tension point, whether it's a sad moment or a catastrophic moment. They will build the color palette to actually you know, try to evoke emotions in the scenery as you get to that point. Yeah. So all of those kinds of details, that's what goes into your ADD. You'll have character sketches and enemy sketches and level layouts.
Concept art.
Yeah, concept art, all that kind of stuff. Great big splash paintings to get you a sense of the feel of that level and so on. That all goes into the art design document. So it's a very important document still. Okay, it's just not useful for what we're going to do today. So we're just going to mention it and then move on.
Yeah.
All right, so that brings us to those UML. The Unified Modeling Language is what UML stands for. It's a general purpose modeling language in the field of software engineering. It has been used for many other things as well. And it's basically just provided as a standard way to visualize the design of some system or subsystem. Mm-hmm. And UML has been evolving since, well, for a long time.
Yeah, it's been around since the 80s, really.
Like, over 20 years, easy.
Yeah.
And it came about sort of when the object-oriented kind of programming languages really started to build up an emphasis, and this was a way for people to design and show to other people, hey, here's how you go and build these systems in an object-oriented kind of manner, as opposed to the old linear programming where everything was a straight storybook and literally went line to line and maybe go-to'd back and made a crazy spaghetti of code. So that's what these diagrams, or this language was really built to describe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
it's not a method of development in itself, it's just a way of describing how you're going to implement these methods.
That's right. So here's an example UML class diagram that you might see for in a technical design document to describe what is in different classes. So we have a model class here, okay, we have a view class and a controller class. And down here, you can see that sometimes they have both properties and methods.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, this class doesn't have any properties at all. It just has methods in terms of internally what it does. And then all these arrows mean different things. Some are dependencies and some are other kinds of relationships that you can get.
And that's what they do. They describe the relationship between each of the objects.
Exactly. So we know which one, you know, either has an instance of another one or which one sometimes extends from another one and so on. And you can use these to also show how they interact versus just how the hierarchy of your classes are going to be laid out. So you could have, you know, two different UML diagram class diagrams for those purposes as well. So a lot of games have enemies, and there's an enemy base class, and from there, you know, you have your ground units and your air units, and then from your ground units, you have sort of your treaded ones, your walker guys, and so on. And that class, you know, inheritance structure can be done through this UML diagram, showing you what new functions get added at each of those levels, what new properties get added at each of those levels, or what you want. And now literally you can hand that off to a bunch of coders and say, you know, you work on this class, can you add this class? When you're done, can you do that whole branch of classes?
Mm-hmm.
And they know basically what it is you want them to be called, what it is that they need, and they just fill in the functionality themselves to do whatever that is.
Yeah, and actually, one thing that I liked about UML, especially with the class diagram, is there's actually tools out there, depending on the language and the tool set that you have, it actually will take this UML and give you stubbed code.
That's right. So you literally submit the UML diagram in there, and it bulks out all your classes for you, puts in the basic properties you just asked for, sets, you can even see in the image, it might be a little hard, but there's plus signs versus minus signs beside some of these. That's inferring which ones are public versus private, and there's also one for protected and so on, and that will get stubbed in right into your code. And so you already have all the variables defined and declared with the naming you used, you have all the functions defined and declared with what you put there.
And I point that out because a lot of people are going, oh man, that seems like a tedious step.
Yeah.
In actuality, if you do it, it's actually going to save you a bunch of time when you go to code because it's going to stub in everything, and then you're just going to go and fill in the specifics of each method or property.
Right. So it's a nice way, and of course, some coder was like, yeah, this is tedious. I want to make this do something useful. So he built a little plugin that lets you shunt that into different kind of code. So that's why we enjoy, you know, working with these to some degree. It gives great communication. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, it is still useful for creating your code base and getting started. Then this is another kind, again, it's the language itself is meant for describing all kinds of things, not just classes or something specific. This is a state machine diagram, and we can see there's different kinds of symbols in UML. That black dot with the arrow coming in is considered always the starting point for these kinds of UML diagrams. And this one is sort of just describing a bank ATM
state
machine. So it comes up, it's always idle. It's waiting for you to show up and start hitting the keys. You know, you put your card in and it activates it. And then inside that activate state, to describe it, I would go and write another state machine diagram showing all the little odds and ends, like you could deposit money, take out some money, maybe just check your account and so on. Mm-hmm. Those would all happen within there. If I canceled out and I didn't want to do anything else, or I say I'm done, it's going to take me back to the idle state and it's going to wait for the next customer. If for some reason something breaks or the idle state detects that something's wrong, it could switch itself into service mode and say, display the out of service message and no longer accept cards or anything like that until, of course, we fix it and it goes back into the idle state. So this is a basic state machine that is describing the overall processes that a bank ATM would use. And the nice thing is you can nest these diagrams, like I said, with the active state, probably has a whole bunch of other options mm-hmm. that are its own state machine and so on and so on. So you can have these cascading diagrams basically, and you can use the upper level ones to describe it to the team, and then you can hand the lower level ones of specific states to a different coder to each develop the software to do just those actions.
Very, very handy.
Right. So again, it's all about describing things to people. And then this was the sequence diagram that I was talking about earlier. We see we have a customer, and really this is his lifetime or his timeline, we describe it. Okay, and then we have an orders timeline, so that would be an instance of the order class, and we probably have an instance of a menu manager over here, and we get to see the customer. He starts hungry, and he comes in, he's hungry for this process, he decides to create an order. The order lasts for some amount of time. It enters a loop, basically, where he adds items into the order over and over again through this whole process. The order class checks if it's available on the menu, and if it is, it comes back and says, you know, either you can't do that or yes, that's great, and so on. And basically, this just keeps looping until he's done adding all his orders, and we can see all the transactions between the different classes, the order in which they happen, and so on. And finally, when it's done, you know, they complete their order and pay, and it goes out to the stock update for the company.
Sequence diagrams are great for things like menu systems and describing the overall lifespan of the gameplay, right? So, like, from the moment that he fires up the game to the moment that he leaves the game, you can actually describe the process.
Sure, and you could use them also for network practices, again, for that security transfer back and forth. So, you know, here's our client coming in, here's the credentials we check, we ask for his password, we check some more, you know, and so on and so on. And all that process, what server you have to contact, who's responsible for that. A lot of MMOs will have sort of that login server first, mm-hmm. and once they pass all that security check and so on, they'll get put into the game server where they should be, and if they go to the auction house or something and they start looking for items, that will usually talk to another server and, of course, verify his account, verify he has enough money to buy whatever he's buying or put whatever item he's putting in there, and that's a separate system. So laying out how those server structures and how those independent clients can talk to one another, you can use sequence diagrams for that and show that lifetime as well.
Yeah, so you can definitely see the power of UML and why you would want to use it and how it keeps like everything structured and describes it to people that may or may not be a coder. Another good thing about UML diagrams is you can explain to someone that isn't a coder, who doesn't understand the technical aspects of it, exactly what's happening at each process.
Yeah. And if you're a game designer, learning UML would be great too, because now when you design your gameplay mechanics, which really is just a system, you could use that previous diagram that I showed, the state machine diagram, basically, to show how you want the combat system to work or how you want powers to interact with one another. Okay, or you could do a sequence diagram for fight mechanics and so on, or whatever key moments you need as a cinematographer and so on, and use this to explain to the coders and explain to other developers and so on, whatever it is, and it's all a language that visually is easy, more or less, to understand, and then they can do their bit that fills in those mm-hmm. blanks.
Yeah, and you know, we talked a lot about documentation and proper maintenance and all this stuff, and the reason that we're talking about this, and this goes for all game design, it's obviously not just for HTML5 and JavaScript games, this goes for everything, but I really wanted to take the time out for this because when I bumped into that project, it was like a red flag being waved, right, when I had these issues, and I thought to myself, if I'm having this, other people are probably having the same issues.
Right.
So, of course, I thought, you know, this is a good idea to step through. So that's kind of why we got a little preachy on you for a little while there. But these are really, really good points that you should take to all your development, not just with HTML5 and JavaScript. So, like I said, let's take we got a little preachy there.
Before that, one more thing then, yeah. So if you're looking for a program to mm-hmm. do the UMLs, right, Visio?
Visio does, yeah, it's
really
good for that.
Star UML. Which also has those plugins for punching out the code stubs for mm-hmm. you and so on. And if you're looking for the details of what other UML diagrams there are or what all these symbols mean and so on, just you know, go out there on the internet, look for UML, and you'll find them everywhere. All kinds of descriptors and telling you and websites.
And dive a little bit deeper, because we didn't talk about what each one of the relationship descriptors are and stuff like that, because it is its own language, so it's something that you want to sit down and work on. But yeah, so let's give them a break. I think they're a little tired of hearing us talk about all the documentation, setup. Right? So let's give them about 10 minutes, and we'll come back in, and we promise we'll be doing some code when you come back. Thank you. We'll see you in 10.
All right.